Howdy y'all, John here again. Time for what happened this week. The show fueled by my good friends beer and coffee at the same time. Let's get to the news. Our lead story, the internet is safe once again. Yes, both the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act have been shelved for the time being. Support for the bills eroded as criticism mounted, and eventually the sponsors of the bills, respectively Senator Harry Reid from Nevada and Representative Lamar Smith from Texas, announced that they're delaying votes on them. Now, they're not dead per se, but we probably won't see them anytime soon, definitely not in their current incarnations. Ars Technica has the details, and reportedly Daryl Issa, a rep from California, was one of the key opponents of the bill. The article states he was planning to hold a hearing featuring the testimony of actual technical experts, something that had been mysteriously missing from Smith's hearings on the bill. Wednesday's internet protests were originally scheduled to coincide with the hearings, but ISA scrapped his hearing after receiving assurances that DNS provisions would be dropped from SOPA. The broader protest went forward anyway. Unquote. Now, this bill transformed from the 800-pound gorilla that would destroy the internet to something so radioactive it might as well have been literally radioactive. It took a little bit more than a single day of awareness from Google blocking out its logo or Anonymous taking down the Department of Justice's webpage. This is the end result of supporters of the bill seeing their own bases of support fade away over the last few months. You remember GoDaddy lost a lot of business because they helped write SOPA. Individual members of the ESA backed off or said nothing at all. Electronic Arts rather notoriously clarified that they never took a position on the bill. Few people gave full-throated defenses of this thing, and eventually even the ESA itself, according to GameSpot, issued a statement saying it no longer supports SOPA. Protests range from purely internet activism to in-person rallies. You could argue the fact that because these bills directly affected the internet, they amplified the effects of internet protest. Nothing super complicated, just a simple, sustained message that software makers and politicians were going to have a lot of pissed off clients and constituents if it went through. Amidst all the chaos, we have an odd episode where the Justice Department and the FBI took down the online locker site Mega Upload, charging 7 people connected to the business with, quote, running an international enterprise based on internet piracy. This is apparently why Anonymous hit the DOJ's website. According to the New York Times, 4 of those 7 people, including founder Kim.com, that's a he, by the way, given name Kim Schmitz, were arrested in New Zealand after a grand jury indictment for 5 counts of copyright infringement and conspiracy. The charges could mean 20 or more years in prison. This simultaneously demonstrates 2 things. 1, that SOPA was hideously unnecessary, because our government already has far-reaching abilities to do this, albeit not as quickly and broadly. And 2, that regulators still don't get the internet, because there are about 1 million other sites, and making an example of one of them does little about the larger issue. Yes, you took down the storage equivalent of Napster. Guess what? There's still RapidShare, MediaFire, FilesTube, ZenSpace, YouSendIt, 4Shared, EasyShare, and so on and so forth. Fact is, even though SOPA and PIPA went down, the environment that created them is still alive and well. There's a reason Occupy Wall Street was just barely able to change discussion in this country and scores of protests worldwide weren't enough to stop the Iraq War. Because knocking out a single bill is possible, but thwarting the powers behind those bills takes a lot more time and effort. Piracy remains an issue that demands a response of some kind, and you can bet the big media conglomerates will come up with something like this in the near future. Rumor has it that SOPA could reemerge as a rider on an anti-child porn bill, which is a scary way of cutting through gridlock that I hadn't considered. Fortunately for now, it's just that, a rumor. But again, this bill came into being because media companies were able to exploit a tech-illiterate Congress, and until we get representatives who know how the internet works, we're sort of stuck with this paradigm. We'll see this issue again. Piracy is a multifaceted problem, so much that even the responses to piracy are usually part of the problem, and thus fixing it requires a lot of change over a long period of time. Ars has a good article covering the way forward, various issues that need to be addressed at every step. I've linked it in the body. Short version, the process needs to be more open, the public allowed some form of input as the bill's being shaped. Real hearings need to be held from differing points of view and legitimate experts on the subject, and key issues need to be separated rather than lumped together, like counterfeit goods versus copyright infringement. One's a physical product and the other's not. Enforcement agencies can still use traditional methods to target specific sites. Ars mentions following the money. Cutting off payments is vastly more efficient than DNS and search engine blocking. Still a blunt instrument, but better than trying to simply make it invisible. I'd like to add that for individual companies, the important thing is to make access to content easier for legit customers. We went over this when discussing Valve and Steam a while back. It's not an accident that it's doing so well. It provides a quality service for the customer and a fairly sophisticated network for the company. Indie games do remarkably well there. Fostering goodwill is important too. It's why I bring up CD Projekt all the time. If you prove you're willing to trust your clients as a rule, if you respond to feedback and work to improve your product, people do notice. It's not an instantaneous process, but it matters over the long haul. Like any other crime, piracy won't be stopped unless you're willing to completely remove all freedom from the internet. You'd need authoritarian measures that make China look like a bastion of liberty, not to mention a data mining system straight out of Deus Ex. It can, however, be dealt with over time, if the backers of SOPA are willing to accept that sometimes the real solution is unglamorous and time-consuming. If there's one constant in this world, it takes longer to build something than it does to destroy. Amazingly, SOPA wasn't the only news in town, although it was a fairly quiet week otherwise. BioWare got a lot of attention, some of it unwanted. MCV has details about an ongoing PvP issue, where this high-level area called Ilium had a rather big balance problem. One side was getting significantly more valor, which is PvP rank rating, than the other for achieving the same objectives. Doing a bit of digging, it looks even worse. Sounds like Imperial players massively outnumbered the Republic players, to the extent they were able to spawn camp the Republic and destroy the turrets covering the spawn point. These turrets give out a ton of valor and instantly respawn. Combined with the above factors, we've got players hitting max valor rank in a matter of hours, which is supposed to take closer to a year. If the Penny Arcade forums are to be believed, this issue supposedly came up on one of their test servers for the 1.1 patch, and BioWare went ahead with it anyway. Now, you could power a city with the number of f**ks I don't give about PvP, but you don't have to be heavily competitive to see the problem here. There were other issues, too. The cancel subscription button on account pages briefly vanished due to a hilariously ill-timed glitch. But the larger point is this is the sort of thing the old Republic can't really afford to have happen. It's one thing to be an MMO with growing pains. Even the successful ones go through those before they find their niche. It's another to be a high-profile, very expensive MMO that is quite obviously gunning for World of Warcraft. I get different figures from different sources for development costs. Again, going by MCV, they cite an analyst that puts the high end of the guessing range close to 500 million. Not an inexpensive gamble for Electronic Arts. The thing is, both players and reviewers seem quite positive about the actual content of the game. Single-player missions, instances, conversation options. All indication is that it's a quality BioWare RPG that just happens to be massively multiplayer, even if the gameplay feels like a reskin of World of Warcraft. It would not surprise me at all to learn the game was quite profitable, although it begs the question of whether it's profitable enough for EA. Somebody's going to want a big return on that investment, and it's up in the air whether the old Republic can deliver. Fortunately for BioWare, they had other things to talk about. Game Informer's Phil Collar had an interview with Casey Hudson about Mass Effect 3. Among other things, I found these tidbits interesting. Hudson talks about how the game won't have discrete mission areas like the second game did. He says, "We wanted to be able to break up the idea of coming into an area and knowing it's an area made for combat, or an area made for talking, or whatever." Recall that they had this to a limited extent in the first game. You sometimes got into fights in non-mission areas, like on the Citadel or at the port in Novaria. I like this idea. 2 was a great game, but its missions were clearly game space, rigidly linear and often no more than shooting galleries marked by a completion screen that itemized what you did along the way. I'm glad to see 3's moving towards something else. It makes for a less obviously gamey experience. He also goes into broad strokes discussion of the overall story arc, how Shepard will have different assets on hand to fight the Reapers. Rather than recruiting individuals, you're taking on, say, the Quarian fleet or something. The big question is how they're going to handle endings, since obviously key people could have been dead based on your actions. Historically, BioWare games usually lead up to the same ending no matter what you're doing, with any changes mostly modular in nature. Dragon Age is a good example. You're killing the Archdemon no matter what, but that ending ceremony can look a lot different based on who made it there and whether they like you or not. Same with Mass Effect. My guess is that any survivors that return will basically plug into the main story at key points, but the overall story will continue the same way without them. It has to, otherwise you don't have a game. It's the reason BioWare doesn't have to account for Shepard dying in 2. The other option involves major plot branches, like in The Witcher 2, but that takes a whole other kind of effort. I admit, even just thinking about Mass Effect 3 and how it's going to wrap everything up, it makes it easy to gloss over the Origin fiasco just this once. I really, really don't want to put Origin on my computer, but it is my go-to machine for anything multi-platform, and that's where my ME2 saves are. God damn it, BioWare, why did you have to make this so hard? One last thing for tonight. I mentioned last week that Zynga picked up another executive from EA, and now Reuters is reporting that the Big Z just bought 4 mobile game companies. Game Doctors, Page 44, HipLogic, and Astro Ape Studios. All well-known big-name developers, of course. Now, they're smaller names, but they have experience for developing for iOS and multi-platforms, while Zynga obviously works mostly through Facebook. My first thought is, wait a minute, didn't we establish a week ago that Zynga is no longer filing for its IPO, and thus should stop acting like it's going to? My second thought is that they're buttering themselves up for a sale, and Pincus is making final inspections of his golden parachute, as I predicted, what was it, a year ago? Almost a year? I don't know, it's been a while. A third, more distant thought is that they're still making a determined effort to have a fallback plan in case their relationship with Facebook becomes less than cozy. But that would require Zynga acting like an actual business and not EA Lite. Look, we saw a lot of strange things happen in 2011. Lots of people hopped on the mobile and social bandwagons like they were express trains to Moneyville. Even people that should probably know better, like Richard Garriott and John Romero. They might be relics of a bygone era of gaming, but they also know how quickly fame and fortune can slip away if you make a big enough mistake. The sad truth is, they'll be fine. Pincus will be fine. They got their money and lived their MTV Cribs lifestyles. If Zynga crashes and burns, it's the people who work for them that suffer. The designer or texture artist collecting a paycheck and turning around to pay rent because the actual process of making a game isn't so glamorous. 2012's off to a running start, it seems. You might not know it to listen to me, but I'm really something of an optimist, albeit a deeply cynical one. We're still governed by people decades our senior that don't really understand how technology has changed things. We're still outsourcing hard labor to cheaper places so we can pretend we don't need it, and the business of our hobby is still run by short-term profits over long-term ideas. But hey, at least SOPA's not passing anytime soon, and investors aren't biting into Zynga. Baby steps, people. We'll get there. Alright, that's all the time I have for tonight. Thanks for joining us, folks. For Random NPC, this is John. I'll see you next week.